Or what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. Donald Trump returned to his campaign roots Thursday in his first major public appearance since Election Day, resembling the brawling campaigner more than the traditional president-to-be as he held court in front of thousands of adoring fans. He also took another swipe at the media.
I mean, how dishonest. How about when a major anchor who hosted a debate started crying when she realized that we won? How about that?
Trump's first stop on his thank you tour to salute his supporters was in Ohio. President Obama on Thursday marked his final time lighting the national Christmas tree with a wish that Americans will care for the sick, the hungry, and the downtrodden this holiday season and treat one another as they would want to be treated. The president said that message rounds out his family's Christian faith and the Americans of all backgrounds. The lighting ceremony tradition began in 1923 and takes place in President's Park, just south of the White House fence. Obama and First Lady Michelle turned on the red, white, and blue lights that adorned the massive tree with the help of their daughter, Sasha. More Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week, but the claims are still at low levels that point to greater job security. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 68 points. The S&P 500 index lost 7. You're listening to VOA News. Princess Cruise Lines will pay $40 million penalty after pleading guilty to 7 federal charges and an illegal ocean pollution. It's the largest ever criminal penalty for deliberate pollution. Friends of the Earth senior marine policy analyst John Katzelstein says it's a likely bigger problem than just cruise lines.
And it extends even beyond the cruise ship industry to the freight industry as well. Tankers, cargo ships, container ships, et cetera. So this is a difficult issue. It's really a concern for environmental groups and others.
The illegal practices came to light when an engineer aboard the Caribbean Princess discovered the, quote, magic pipe in 2013 and told investigators about it. Princess said it was extremely disappointed that employees violated company policy and federal law. United Nations officials are again warning that civilians in eastern Aleppo, Syria, are in a state of extreme desperation. They're calling for a humanitarian pause to allow safe passage of the seriously wounded out of the besieged city while allowing food and medicine to reach the estimated 1.5 million people inside. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN calls for a humanitarian pause have repeatedly been ignored, and as time goes by, conditions for civilians trapped inside East Aleppo continue to deteriorate. UN food stocks have run out, and the number of wounded unable to receive treatment continues to rise. East Aleppo's hospitals are no longer functioning because Syrian and Russian forces have repeatedly bombed them. Russia proposes opening 4 humanitarian corridors to allow the wounded to leave East Aleppo and aid convoys to enter the city. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
Starbucks says CEO Howard Schultz, who transformed the chain into a global coffee brand, is stepping down from that role at the chain that he joined more than 30 years ago. The Seattle-based company announced Thursday that Kevin Johnson, who was named president and chief operating officer last year, will become chief executive as of April 3rd. Schultz will become executive chair to focus on innovation and social impact activities, among other things.
Song, song, blue, everybody knows.
Neil Diamond took Song Sung Blue to the top of the charts and now promises to leave no song unsung when he takes to the stage next year for a world tour. The 75-year-old singer-songwriter plans a 50-year anniversary world tour. I'm Lori London in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Friday, December 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan refutes claims of an impending genocide in the country.
The war that should have brought concern to those who think there is an ethnic war in South Sudan has already come to an end through peace agreement or resolution of conflict in the Republic of South Sudan. So I don't know who the ethnic cleansing is actually directed at.
Atain Wekatain is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. Two more armed groups agreed to end the use of child soldiers. The United Nations delivers life-saving medicine and hospital equipment to health centers across Sudan, and Africa uses ports to fight environmental degradation.
The forest is like the heartbeat. Anything that you bring down in the forest has a negative impact on the environment. If we cut the forest, we are destroying the key things that we are supposed to enjoy in the environment.
That's Jeanette Mukoko of the World Wildlife Fund. A group known to cause riots and chaos during elections in Ghana says all is well for Ghana's presidential and parliamentary election next week. And a drought-tolerant grass boosts milk and meat production in Kenya. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post roundup and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir says his country is not on the verge of ethnic cleansing because the tribes are the source of the country's strength. Atain Wekatain says the problem in South Sudan is a political one which the country is trying to resolve by signing a peace agreement. The head of the UN Human Rights Commission, Yasmin Suka, warned on Thursday of an impending ethnic cleansing in South Sudan. Suka, who led a 10-day UN human rights team to South Sudan, said people are being displaced from their homes through a process of starvation, gang rape, and the burning of villages. But presidential spokesman Wek Atei says those stoking fears of an impending genocide in South Sudan are probably doing so because they want the international community to put more money into South Sudan to provide jobs for expatriates to live in South Sudan.
The war that should have brought concern to those who think there is an ethnic war in South Sudan has already come to an end through peace agreement or resolution of conflict in the Republic of South Sudan. And as I speak with you, the implementation of peace agreement is intact. And the major fighting force have come to be peace partners. So I don't know who the ethnic cleansing is actually directed at when you look at such a report.
But as you know, sir, your government is engaged in war. Mr. Riek Machar has announced that his group is going to fight your government. So the assumption is that because of the conflict between you and Dr. Riek Machar's forces, perhaps that's where this cleansing is coming from. Because Dr. Riek Machar comes from a different ethnic group and President Salva Kiir comes from a different ethnic group.
You know, those reports are emanating from the people who don't know South Sudan, by the way. They are not aware of the root causes of the problem in South Sudan. And they want to assume to know. But if they were to know exactly how our ethnics work, they should realize that this ethnicity in South Sudan has been there before even the creation of United Nations and before creation of any other rights organizations. They were living side by side. They have been source of our strength, and therefore they should understand this. To be clear, the ethnic group that Dr. Riek Machar belonged to and the ethnic group of President Salva Kiir has never been having any problems. What is in South Sudan is a political problem. And that political problems came to an end as a result of peace agreement that being signed. As I speak with you, the ethnic group that you think Riek Machar belonged to is now being headed by General Taban Dengai, who is implementing peace agreement together with President Salva Kiir.
The UN Human Rights Commission says that your government and the rebel armies are recruiting forcefully recruiting soldiers, including children, which they say is an indication that the both of you are preparing for violent clashes, particularly as the dry season comes closer.
Well, to challenge such thinking, we are not recruiting anybody. The government of South Sudan has no money even to pay those who are already there in the army. So why recruiting more soldiers? But there are those who doesn't want to see the government coming out of this. And there are those who doesn't want South Sudan actually to come out of this. Otherwise, they should have actually mind their own business. South Sudan is not on the verge of ethnic cleansing whatsoever. I want to register it to you, and it is not going to happen because being tribes is a source of our strength. And what we have is a political problem which we are about to solve.
What do you say to those who say there is an impending genocide in South Sudan because of what is happening, what they see is happening? What do you say?
I will challenge them and say there will be no genocide in South Sudan. And by the way, I don't mind those who want to look for more jobs by trying to create fear in South Sudan so that the United Nations or those donors continue to inject money so that more jobs are found for foreigners to live in South Sudan. Otherwise, there's no any verge of genocide in South Sudan. And I would challenge them. I am official. From me, if there is any planning from the side of government to inflict genocide on a certain ethnicity, we'll challenge that one day and challenge everybody that it will not happen.
Aten Wek Aten is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. A humanitarian group says its work of persuading armed groups to stop the recruitment of child soldiers is making slow but steady progress. The group, known as Geneva Call, says it received pledges by two rebel groups to end the practice during a recent three-day training workshop which taught respect for international law. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This unlikely gathering brought together 31 leaders, commanders, and advisors of 21 armed movements from 11 countries. Participants came from some of the world's worst conflict zones: Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Representatives from the United Nations and specialized agencies also were present. The workshops focused on the need to better protect and educate children and the respect for international law. Geneva Call Policy Director Pascal Bongard says his organization plays a complementary role with the United Nations and was involved in getting the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North to agree to end child recruitment. He tells VOA during the meeting, a rebel group in the Democratic Republic of Congo also signed a commitment to work toward this goal as well. He says his organization can deal with certain armed groups, such as Turkey's Kurdish PKK, with whom the United Nations cannot engage.
But also some movements that are listed, the UN cannot engage because they have restrictions from the government, from the states. And so we have more flexibility. We are not a UN organization, so somehow it provides less high profile, and we have flexibility or capacity to access some of these movements.
The United Nations lists 51 armed groups as having committed grave violations against children. Bongard says getting off this so-called list of shame acts as an incentive to some armed groups to end their use of child soldiers. He says Geneva Call works with these groups to help them implement the agreement they have signed and in demobilizing and integrating the child soldiers into their home communities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, the second day of December. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. The United Nations has delivered the first batch of life-saving medicine and hospital equipment for health centers across Sudan. The European-made drugs were purchased by the UN using money from the Sudanese government to avoid the U.S.-backed international sanctions imposed on Sudan, including financial transactions. As Namio Biagio reports from Khartoum, the drugs arrived on the heels of sharp hikes in prices that threatened to cause renewed political unrest across the country.
The urgently needed medicine was delivered a few days ago as part of an agreement signed in March by the United Nations Development Programme, or UNDP, and Sudan's Ministry of International Cooperation. Marta Reuters, the UNDP representative in Sudan, says the UN signed the deal with the government so that innocent Sudanese civilians would not be hurt by sanctions imposed on the government of President Omar al-Bashir.
The project aims to overcome challenges of access to convertible currency and restrictions on international banking transactions that can provide medicines to vulnerable populations across Sudan.
The economic embargo on Mr. Bashir's government was first imposed in 1997 for accusations of harboring terrorist organizations in the country. Later, the sanctions were tightened for war crimes and crimes against humanity that President Bashir is accused of orchestrating in Sudan's Darfur region. Reuters says the new project is worth $60 million and will expand over the next 3 years.
And we hope that this innovative approach to delivering medicines, to medical and laboratory equipment and consumables to Sudan will be a first step towards alleviating the suffering of many patients. So we are looking forward to developing and to building more partnerships with the government of Sudan, with the Federal Ministry of Health, with the NMSF, for the benefit and the health of the people of Sudan over the coming years.
Bahar Idris Abu Garda is Sudan's Minister of Health. He says the cost of medicine has shot up in recent weeks, causing outrage. But speaking in Arabic, he says this new joint project with UNDP is good news for the Sudanese people.
These days there is a lot of noise about medicines, but through this cooperation with the UN to make available medicines that cannot otherwise be secured, I think it is very important and timely.
Khartoum resident Mohammed Mustafa says the delivery of medical supplies is good news, but it will not solve what he calls the healthcare crisis in Sudan.
Our problem here with health and healthcare, you know, is not sanctions. Sanctions hurt Sudanese people, yes, but the big problem is the government. They don't put essential services like healthcare, like education, as a priority.
Mustafa says healthcare remains very expensive in Sudan, and ordinary citizens are not able to pay for services at private hospitals and clinics across the country. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Khartoum.
As Ghanaians prepare to vote in presidential and parliamentary elections next Wednesday, the leader of a group that is usually associated with causing riots and chaos during elections says all is well. The Zongos are mostly Muslim and Hausa-speaking in Ghana. There have been rumors that some politicians have hired Zongo youth to intimidate and harass opposing politicians. VOA's Peter Clotte, who is on assignment to cover the Ghana election, spoke with Chief Alhaji Baba Imoru Issa, the national spokesman for the Zongo chiefs.
I would say so far so good. Within the Zongo community, if you come to Nima in this environment, as one of the leading Zongo communities in the country. But I would say, what we have observed, there seems to be a kind of understanding between the parties. You know, there's what they call keep fit exercise, where they come up on Saturdays. It has been agreed at the Nima police station, for instance, there will be a route where part A will go on this route, the next time part B will go on this route. And when even they come meeting each other, there's kind of understanding. So far, I would say the situation is good, it's under control.
What happened recently close to Nima police station where a presidential candidate and their supporters supposedly or allegedly came under attack by another party? So they said it's the fault of the Zongo community.
Well, this is what we were told, the information that was. I think the matter is under investigation. Not until we have been able to get the true picture, it will be difficult to say that whether it is Zongo elements who are responsible for those things. Because in the past, that person could have been there. Anything like this, it is straight attributed to the Zongo people that they are responsible for environment and what have you. But let us wait and find out if for the past 3 months there's a serious political activities in the communities. And I said, apart from that incident, there have not been anywhere so far. So I would say so far, so good. And then, why the chief, the leadership, the imams, they're all involved in sensitizing the community. Peace before and during and after the elections. There have been a lot of fora with the youth, women organizations, educating them the need to have a very peaceful community. And to a large extent, I would say, people are responding.
Well, situations have been reported where political parties supposedly hire people from the Zongo communities to create problems not only in the Zongo communities, but elsewhere in cities across the country, Accra and elsewhere.
Well, this, I would say, my brother, is still a perception because it's difficult. It's an allegation that people are being hired. Who is doing that or which particular party is doing what or not? But what I know, there's a campaign organization, every party, you know, whenever you want to do something, you want to organize rallies, you want to organize do things, money comes in for that organization. I wouldn't dispute. But then for the money to be given to people to go and cause trouble, because we have won our youth. Because if you take money to go and cause problem, are you so sure that if you go, you will come back with your two arms, with your two eyes, because you feel you are going to do something, some harm. Do you know how the other person, other party, is also ready to meet you?
Our Chief Alhaji Baba Imoru Issa, National Spokesman for the Zongo Chiefs of Ghana. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty, who was on assignment in Accra, Ghana. Kenya is expanding cultivation of a relatively new nutritious drought-resistant forage grass for cattle that could boost milk production, resulting in higher incomes for families. The grass is already in use in several countries in East Africa. According to researchers, it doubles the milk output. For VOA, Lenny Ruvaga reports from Siaya in Kenya.
The Oremos begin their daily routine by cutting grass for their prized cow. Both husband and wife, subsistence farmers in Siaya, about 400 kilometers from Kenya's capital, Nairobi, turned to dairy farming 2 years ago to supplement their income. In the past, their milk production was around 3 liters. On average, they earned $100 a month, barely enough for their basic needs before changing to the new fodder. However, since adopting a new variety of grass known as Brachiaria, they noticed a drastic change in milk production and their income, which increased to $200.
This grass is better because it makes us get a lot of milk from our dairy cow. Before we use it, we were getting only 3 liters. But after we started using it, we switched to 10 liters per day, 12 liters per day.
About 1,000 farmers in the area are registered at the Samalanga Dairy Cooperative, which processes the milk on their behalf. Jacob Ojal, an official at the co-op, says the plant has seen an increase in milk production. Ojal says that during the dry season, farmers who haven't adopted the new grass suffer losses.
Not all farmers have adopted the Bulgaria species. Because of the maybe shortage of the seeds around, and also the price of the seeds, how to get them. But the few farmers who have, so you find that during the dry spells, the farmers who have not adopted that one, they get it hard to, they have a problem in feeding their animals.
Plant breeders at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, SEAT, in collaboration with the International Livestock Research Institute, ILRI, began research on this particular Brachiaria grass 5 years ago. Dr. Anne Nottenbert, one of the scientists on the project, says the new variety of grass is improving livelihoods of farmers. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Siaya, Kenya.
Activists are using the Women's Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Cameroon to campaign for the protection of the continent's forest and animal species. The campaign, called Sports for Nature, is spearheaded by conservationist groups who say some of Africa's natural resources are on the verge of extinction. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
It is evening in Yaoundé and birds sing at a makeshift park near the Amadou Ahidjo Stadium, one of the sites of the 2016 Women's Football Africa Cup of Nations. Conservationist Neville Tanye points towards a crocodile walking nearby and describes the danger it poses to workers trying to maintain a pond.
When we provoke the crocodile to leave the pond area, it goes towards the side where there's no water and it normally rests in that area. When we go in to clean the pond, we have to drain the water out because the crocodile is perfectly adapted to life in water. In water, the crocodile is extremely fast because it will use the tail to swim and the back feet are webbed. So in water, it's at home.
Tanyi and fellow activists fear a day when they will not be able to marvel at crocodiles and the thousands of other animals that roam the African continent. Professor Zach Twenge of the International Center for Research in Agroforestry elaborates.
Just imagine that in 20 years, you only show photograph to your child. It will be a disaster.
Organizers of the Sports for Nature campaign hope to prevent that disaster by convincing Africans that protecting the continent's abundant wildlife is in their best interest. The World Wildlife Fund says national parks and wildlife reserves in Africa have lost between 60 to 80% of their lions, elephants, buffalo, and other protected species since 1980. The WWF and other conservationist groups say some species may disappear entirely unless poaching, global warming, population growth, and unregulated development are brought in check. Activists say the Sports for Nature campaign will return to future sporting events to promote the beauty of protected animals. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Thank you, James. We begin with the Commonwealth Games, where South Africa says it remains fully committed to hosting the 2022 Commonwealth Games in Durban, despite failing to meet this week's deadline to resolve a number of issues. A local organizing committee wasn't set up within the 180 days of winning the bid, and they haven't deposited an initial payment of $2.42 million. Pierre Emerick Aubameyang, reigning African Footballer of the Year, who has been clocked doing the 30 meters in 3.7 seconds, has challenged nine-time Olympic gold medalist Usain Bolt to a one-on-one over that distance. The 27-year-old attacker wants the chance to win an individual one with the fastest man in history. In basketball news, Tunisia Champions Club Africain secured a place in next month's Federation of International Basketball Association Africa Champions Cup, thanks to a dominating performance at Africa Zone 1 qualifier held in El Hasima in Morocco. The Tunisians, under the tutelage of Portuguese coach Vasco Curado, secured two wins in as many games after edging out AS Sale of Morocco before knocking out GS Petrolas of Algeria. And now to rugby, where the national women's 7 team in Kenya are through to the main cup quarterfinal after beating Ireland women development side 2012 in Dubai Sevens on Thursday. In table tennis news, Nigeria's Arnaud Quadri maintained his status for three consecutive months as world number 25 in the December ITTF world ranking released on Thursday by the World Table Tennis ruling body. With just 1 point, Arnaud Quadri garnered in his second exit at the Austrian Open. The 2014 ITTF star player ends 2016 as the highest ranked African player in the world. In football news, Cameroon are staying focused and are not letting the challenge of beating Nigeria, Africa's most decorated side, get in the way of their preparations for the finals of the African Women's Cup of Nations on Saturday. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. That's it for this Friday, December 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a good weekend.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.